revolution in the history of resistance post October 7 and after the introduction of the equation of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In the Yemeni situation and the security of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, there is a direct impact on the American strategic security concept over an extended period of decades. Converging at the intersection of navigation security, energy security, and the security of the Zionist occupying entity symbolized by the Red Sea. Now, every day, the Yemeni armed forces challenge this strategic concept of American security, leaving the United States with limited options. Either exert pressure to stop the Israeli aggression, the Israeli entity aggression on Gaza, or engage in a broader war that would disrupt navigation, impede energy flow, and turn the Red Sea into a war zone. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator and also journalist at Al Akhbar newspaper, Lebanese daily newspaper. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Awi. Now, there is a clear development in the history of the resistance after October 7th. Al-Aqsa flood operation after the introduction of the equation of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. How significant, in your view, is this new role by the Yemeni armed forces?
Undoubtedly, the Yemeni contribution within the support fronts for the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip, aiming to stop the aggression against the Palestinians, gains international significance. This distinguishes the Yemeni front from other fronts in southern Lebanon and Iraq. So far, the real impacts of Yemeni support on the global American strategy, specifically in the Indo-Pacific region, have not been fully assessed. The Zionist role aligns with this American strategy to enhance trade with Southeast Asian countries, part of an attempt to encircle and undermine China. Today, Yemen's geographical location, coupled with the escalating strength due to the ongoing aggression for 9 years, has given them the ability, power and determination in targeting the U.S. strategy before discussing any economic harm to the Israeli entity economy. Hence, we understand why Washington is very disturbed by this Yemeni contribution and why the U.S. attempts to garner international support, viewing it as an effort to undermine the Yemeni resistance and its contributions to supporting resistance in Gaza.
Well, Mr. Ali, the two giant shipping companies, the Danish Maersk and the German Hapag-Lloyd, have announced the suspension of their voyages in the Red Sea, with operations being put on hold until further notice. This is what the statements of the two companies said. This marks a significant development in the Red Sea, obviously, and in the Red Sea standoff in general, and its impact on international navigations, since these two companies represent about 21.8% of the global trade. That's huge numbers, billions of dollars here. Is that an enough pressure message to the United States and the West to oblige them to take action against the Yemeni armed resistance in the Red Sea? We did hear the Pentagon saying certain stuff and saying that the U.S. defense minister has a trip this week to West Asia. What do you think about that?
I believe the situation is the opposite. The United States has been trying for weeks to engage major world powers in order to secure an international decision, preferably from the UN Security Council, to form a global force to confront Yemenis in the Bab el-Mandeb area. However, there hasn't been international enthusiasm. Reports leaked from China indicate that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken tried unsuccessfully to persuade China towards this direction. I think the Americans pressured maritime companies to issue such statements, aiming to impose a de facto situation on the international community, causing a paralysis in trade through the Red Sea. This is an attempt to enforce a new reality. The U.S. is trying to impose a new reality alongside the announcement of the alliance it desires, forming a military force in the Arabian Sea and the Red Sea. However, strategically looking at the position of military vessels and aircraft carriers, this alliance has been in place for years, ostensibly to prevent arms smuggling to Yemen, whether in the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea, or the Gulf of Oman. Therefore, this U.S. move seems to be merely symbolic to justify their upcoming actions in that region.
Well, we did hear the U.S. envoy to Yemen, Mr. Tim Lenderking. I have so much to say about that man, but I will refrain. He told Reuters that the United States wants to form the widest possible maritime alliance allegedly to protect ships in the Red Sea and send a, I quote, significant signal to the Ansarullah that there will be no tolerance for further attacks. How do you think Yemen will react to these threats?
I believe one of the unannounced U.S. objectives for forming this alliance is to serve the previously declared strategy of building new alliances and reviving old ones. In this case, we have an existing alliance that has been in place for years. Any military move by the U.S. and its allies toward the Yemeni mainland is likely to trigger natural reactions from Sana'a. Just envision a scenario where there is indeed a confrontation, such as a Western American attack on locations in Sana'a or the Yemeni coast. Without a doubt, there will be reactionary responses involving anti-ship missiles, drones, and possibly even naval mines, potentially causing a global disruption in maritime navigation. This, of course, will put pressure on the global economy. Beyond the maritime and navigation aspect, there's the issue of oil facilities. Yemen is officially still in a state of war with the coalition of aggression attacking it, and the ceasefire is ongoing without formal renewal. This presents an opportunity for Sana'a to target energy sources and oil reservoirs, causing hardships for Americans. If the situation escalates into a near-war scenario in the southern Arabian Peninsula, it would lead to a spike in oil prices coinciding with upcoming U.S. elections, causing devastating effects on the U.S. and Western economies.
Well, it's in less than a minute, but wouldn't that be an opportunity for Mohammed bin Salman to re-engage in war against Yemen?
Mohammed bin Salman is aware of the significant repercussions on Saudi Arabia's economy and his Vision 2030 plan. Hence, we've been witnessing leaked media reports for weeks, suggesting that Saudi Arabia is sending messages to Sana'a, indicating a lack of interest in escalating tensions with Yemen. The U.S. has been trying to get Saudi Arabia involved in this so-called international coalition to deter the Yemeni involvement in the fight against Zionist Israeli aggression and genocide in Gaza. Yet, so far, we have not seen real enthusiasm from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia towards any escalation with Yemen. I believe that the Yemenis are fully aware what it means for Mohammed bin Salman to allow another round of violence against Yemen. For instance, it means that the Saudi oil refineries would again come under fire with Yemeni missiles. And it also means that the Saudi much-anticipated Vision 2030 will not see the light of day in the upcoming 7 years. MBS also knows this very well. He is adamant on making Vision 2030 a done deal, that he is willing to not join any new coalition of aggression against the Yemeni armed forces. MBS was aiming to build a fresh start with Yemen. Any sudden unwelcome moves would spark another wave of violence, a violence that would for sure light up the entire Arabian Peninsula, meaning that not only KSA will suffer the consequences, rather the shockwave of consequences will affect all the Arabian Peninsula regimes. Consequently, there is a push to expedite reaching a political agreement between the two countries in negotiations that have been stalled for 2 years.
Well, that definitely sounds interesting. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator and journalist at Al Akhbar, for joining us to tell us the latest of what might happen considering the Yemeni armed forces attempt to perform a maritime blockade against the Zionist entity in support of Palestine. Thanks a million for your time and your contribution. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the confrontations between the resistance axis and the Zionist and American entity are escalating.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
it is certain that all the fronts in the confrontation with the Zionist entity have moved simultaneously. What is definite is that these fronts have significantly contributed to solidifying the Palestinian cause as a central issue within the project of the resistance axis. They did not wait for a signal from anyone to start targeting the institutions of the Zionist entity from southern Lebanon to the Red Sea, including Eilat, passing through Iraq and Syria with a particular focus on Palestine. More details in the following report.
The recent Israeli entity aggression on Gaza and its subsequent expansion of military operations beyond the borders of Gaza, reaching the southern border of Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen in the Red Sea, has created an atmosphere of regional tension. At this stage, the axis of resistance, primarily composed of cohesive native armed factions, has emerged as a key player. These factions promote themselves as advocates of resistance as a strategic choice against Zionist Israel and the United States of America, positioning it as the sole tool for the liberation of Palestinian territories, with Al-Quds at the forefront, while backing the resistance in Gaza. For the first time since the consolidation of the axis of resistance and the alliances within it, we see it engaged in such a significant and wide-ranging battle within the framework of the Al-Aqsa flood battle. It is no secret that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a relationship of support, endorsement, and coordination with the countries of the axis of resistance through relations with Arab countries such as Palestine, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Lebanon. The discussion about the axis of resistance and the struggle of the axis of resistance against the Israeli entity is not new. However, what is contemporary today is that the Axis is leading its first significant battle against the Israeli entity, and behind it, the United States of America. Various strikes have been carried out against U.S. occupation bases and the Zionist entity in the region, but the battle tactics employed by the operations room of the Axis of Resistance have greatly assisted in supporting Gaza in the Al-Aqsa flood battle. It is essential to recognize that Yemen's intervention has transformed the battle from a supportive one into a strategic one at the global level. Meanwhile, in South Lebanon, the 106-kilometer front along the border with the occupied Palestinian territories has undoubtedly become a major concern for both the United States of America and Zionist Israel. Additionally, it poses a challenge for Western countries, especially those with contingents within peacekeeping forces in South Lebanon. The operations have increased and their geographic origins have expanded. Besides Yemen and Lebanon, there have been almost daily attacks with regular missile strikes and drone attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and Syria. The pace of targeting U.S. occupation bases in Syria and Iraq is escalating. The resistance has altered its approach, intensifying the targeting both quantitatively and qualitatively. The number of targeting operations in a single day for a single base has increased significantly. For example, the Ain al-Assad base recorded 3 strikes within a few hours last Tuesday, December 12, highlighting a current trend where rocket barrages have become a characteristic of the ongoing escalation. This scene carries within it a decision by the resistance to transition to more impactful strikes against U.S. forces, potentially hastening their withdrawal from both Iraq and Syria.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Ms. Vanessa Bailey, independent journalist and very dear friend. It's a pleasure having you on with us, Vanessa, today to discuss these escalatory confrontations between the axis of resistance and the American occupation and the Zionist occupation in West Asia. But for the first time since the integration of the resistance axis in West Asia, we see that it is waging such a real and broad battle within the framework of the Palestinian Al-Aqsa battle, beginning with Hezbollah in Lebanon, which shares 106 kilometer with Palestine, and with the Zionist entity basically in direct confrontation with the Zionist entity since October 8, 2023. How has Hezbollah's attack served the resistance in Gaza?
Well, Hezbollah's campaign and, of course, the tremendous sacrifices made by Hezbollah resistance fighters has been tremendously beneficial to the resistance, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, of course, where there is a much lower key, or in the sense of media coverage, but the same kind of ethnic cleansing operation continuing. Of course, what Hezbollah's operations have done, although they have been strategically very controlled and contained to try and prevent the escalation that, of course, the US and Israel and the UK and the EU cartel are looking for, It has effectively kept the Zionist forces in the north of the occupied territories busy with Hezbollah and unable, therefore, to send reinforcements to Gaza and to the West Bank to help with the ethnic cleansing programs that are ongoing in those areas of Palestinians. And equally, of course, what it has done has had a tremendous impact upon the settlements, the Zionist settlements in the northern territories, actually evacuating almost all of them and leaving them as ghost towns. Of course, this is another wound in the side of Israel, because the loss of settler communities from inside the occupied territories effectively means that there is no need for Israel to exist. Mm-hmm. And so therefore these two wounds, first of all, the keeping the Zionist forces occupied in this area along this border, but also, as I said, the evacuation of the settlements all along that border, mm-hmm. is a tremendous psychological effect upon the
Definitely.
Zionist regime and population.
Moving on to another front for the Axis of Resistance, the escalation of resistance operation against the American occupation bases, especially U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria, indicate that the Axis of Resistance has actually begun to deal with the core conspirator against the Arab and Islamic nations and humanity as a whole, actually, meaning the United States of America here. So far, the Pentagon has confirmed that at least 70 of its soldiers were injured as a result of repeated attacks on its bases in Syria and Iraq by the resistance. How will the U.S. be able to deal with this unprecedented escalation at so many levels?
Well, of course, what they're doing in Syria is to trigger their various proxies, which include ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the Kurdish separatists in the northeast, to attack Syrian Arab army positions in central Syria and in northern Hama, northern Latakia, west of Aleppo. And those attacks since October the 7th have intensified in coordination with the Islamic resistance and the Palestinian resistance factions within Syria that are using Syrian territory to carry out attacks not only on the U.S. bases, which are priority, but also against the Zionist-occupied Golan territories. And of course, what we have seen then also is the primary proxy of the U.S. Alliance in the Middle East, Israel, carrying out consistent and systematic air aggression against Syria, including yesterday when they targeted one of the air defense bases in the western countryside of Damascus. So the U.S. is waging, for the time being, a proxy war against the resistance factions in Iraq and in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also saw that after more than 70 days, it is no longer a secret that the United States of America is effectively leading the war on the Palestinian people in Gaza in such a genocidal way, and it is in their hands to stop this genocide or to continue with this genocide, and they're choosing to continue. It is no longer hidden that the United States of America's fear the expansion of the battle at a larger scale, threatening their overall strategies in the region, especially with the Yemen being such a vital heavy player in this, in the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandeb. What do you think is the United States' post-war strategy, and maybe the resistance one, if there is one exists, if there is a post-war day to begin with?
Yeah. Well, I think for the resistance axis, the nations that are currently taking part in the resistance and have not betrayed the Palestinian cause, there is a need to try, as I said, to control the escalation that the U.S. is looking for. I tend to see Israel now very much, and Netanyahu very much, as Zelensky and Ukraine. It's nothing more than a proxy war for the U.S., and Israel is the instrument that they're using to expand the war against Hezbollah, for example, and into Lebanon. We've seen many threats from Israel, which of course are indirectly coming from the United States, that if Hezbollah doesn't withdraw to the north of the Litani River, then Beirut will be turned into Khan Yunus. Are these empty threats? Are these desperate threats? From Israel, I would suggest yes, but from the U.S. that is looking and has been looking for escalation for some time, I believe they are looking for any justification or pretext to escalate both into Lebanon itself, into Syria, into Iraq, into Yemen. We've seen the potential of a coalition being formed of traitor Arab states with EU states, the UK and the US, to target Yemen, because Yemen, as you said, is having the greatest effect against the Zionist entity and against its controllers, let's say, rather than its allies. So I think the danger is that the US is looking for this escalation. It's looking to prevent the rise of BRICS, the rise of Iran in the region, and the only way that it sees that it can do that is by effectively destroying the resistance axis nations and taking control of more territory. So then we see the plan for Greater Israel coming into play, of course. And again, as I said, the US is very much using the current extremist Zionist regime and its forces as an instrument to achieve as much of this as it can, just as it did with Zelensky in Ukraine against Russia. Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems every day it's looking more and more like it is the day before the Day of Judgment. Everything seems like it's going to explode. I want to thank you very much, Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist from Damascus, talking to us about the recent coordinated escalations of the axis of resistance against U.S. occupation and Zionist Israel in support of the Palestinian resistance, obviously. Thank you very much for being with us. Thanks a million for your contribution to our show. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. I'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The New York trial judge overseeing Donald Trump's civil fraud trial has written a scathing denial of the former president's latest attempt to toss the state attorney general's case against him, a bad sign for the former U.S. president. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story. Former President Donald Trump is on trial in New York in a $250 million civil lawsuit that could alter the personal fortune and the real estate empire that helped propel Donald Trump to the White House. Trump, his sons Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr., and other top Trump Organization executives are accused by New York Attorney General Letitia James of engaging in a decade-long scheme in which they used numerous acts of fraud and misrepresentation to inflate Donald Trump's net worth in order to get more favorable loan terms. The trial comes after the judge in the case ruled in a partial summary judgment that Donald Trump had submitted fraudulent valuations for his assets, leaving the trial to determine additional actions and what penalty, if any, the defendants should receive. The former president has denied all wrongdoing, and his attorneys have argued that Trump's alleged inflated valuations were a product of his business skill. Judge Arthur Engoron has denied Donald Trump's most recent motion for a directed verdict to end his civil fraud trial. In a blistering ruling, the judge not only denied the motion but also opted to explain the flaws, as he sees it, in many of Donald Trump's arguments at the trial. Addressing the testimony of defense accounting expert Eli Bartov, who Trump proudly and repeatedly declared found no accounting fraud of any kind, Judge Engoron flatly dismissed Bartov's findings by saying he lost credibility by doggedly attempting to justify every misstatement. Bartov is a tenured professor, but all that his testimony proves is that for $1 million or so, some experts will say whatever you want them to say, Judge Engoron wrote. The judge also rejected assertions from Trump's lawyers that any financial misstatements are beyond the case's statute of limitations. Closing is not a get-out-of-jail-free card for future misstatements. All that is required is a false statement used in business. The subject financial statements fit that definition to a T, Judge Engoron wrote. Engoron also suggested he didn't buy Donald Trump's argument that fining the former president for ill-gotten gains was not merited in the case because his lenders were happy with the transactions. That the instant lenders made millions of dollars and were happy with the transactions does not mean that they were not damaged by lending at lower interest rates than they otherwise would have, the judge wrote. Calling Trump's claims misstatements at best and fraud at worst, Judge Engoron wrote that valuations as elucidated ad nauseum in this trial can be based on different criteria analyzed in different ways, but a lie is still a lie. The judge ended his ruling by reminding the parties about the date for closing arguments in the case, currently set for 11th of January. In a letter to the judge, Arthur Engoron, a lawyer for the New York Attorney General, said Donald Trump's most recent request for a directed verdict in the case is nothing more than a political stunt designed to provide Donald Trump, his co-defendants, and their counsel with soundbites for press conferences, through social posts, and cable news appearances. Trump's lawyers on Friday made their fifth motion for a directed verdict to end the case for lack of evidence, which Judge Engoron earlier said he was all but certain to deny. The judge has rejected all four of Donald Trump's previous motions for a directed verdict. Unlike a fine Bordeaux, defendant's case for a directed verdict does not improve with age, State Attorney Andrew Armour wrote on Monday's letter to the judge. Andrew Armour also argued that Trump's request was not merited given the evidence presented at the trial, saying that nor does any of the testimony from the most ineffective team of experts that defendants' money can buy change the analysis. Defendants are once again whistling past the graveyard by relying on arguments the court has already rejected, Andrew Armour said, referring in part to Judge Engoron's pre-trial partial summary judgment ruling, in which he found that Donald Trump used fraudulent statements to conduct his business affairs. Cable broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. The New York trial judge overseeing Donald Trump's civil fraud trial wrote a scathing denial of the former president's latest attempt to toss the state attorney general's case against him, potentially a preview of a tough outcome for Donald Trump as the trial process winds down. Judge Arthur Engoron slammed Donald Trump's accounting experts and rejected key points of the defense in an order on Monday, denying a motion for a directed verdict filed by Donald Trump's attorneys after trial testimony ended last week. It would be a glaring flaw to assume testimony from Trump accounting experts Eli Bartov and Jason Flemons are true and accurate, the judge wrote. The case record proves there are many material misstatements on Trump's personal financial statements, according to Judge Engoron. Bartov is a tenured professor, but all his testimony proves is that for $1 million or so, some experts will say whatever you want them to say, Judge Engoron wrote. By doggedly attempting to justify every misstatement, Professor Bartov has lost all credibility. Judge Engoron added, defendants also trot out two of their standard canards, that valuations are subjective and that the law only penalizes material deviations. These both fall into the category, I'd let no one be fooled. Evaluation can be based on different criteria and analyzed in different ways, the judge said, but a lie is still a lie. Trump attorney Chris Keyes called Engoron's order a complete failure to address the legal elements of the claims to be decided and a rejection of the real facts from the real participants in the real world. Based on the decision, it appears the Attorney General's burden of proof does not matter, the testimony from the involved bankers does not matter, application of governing accounting standards does not matter, the express language of the financial statements does not matter, and the ruling from the First Department does not matter. All that seems to matter is arriving at a predetermined destination, the attorney, Chris Keyes, said in a statement. Judge Engoron on Monday also knocked a defense argument frequently touted by Donald Trump that disclaimers on his financial statements protect him from liability. They are not disclaimers at all. They have not defendant's statements, and they certainly do not shield defendants from liability. If anything, they expose defendants to liability, the judge wrote. Judge Engoron also said he found the Attorney General's expert on disgorgement credible and said that the banks that lent Donald Trump money were injured despite defense claims that the banks love Trump's business. If you pay a lower interest rate on a loan by overstating the value of any of your assets, thus lowering the perceived risk to the lender, your gains are ill-gotten, Judge Engoron wrote. That the instant lenders made millions of dollars and were happy with the transactions does not mean that they were not damaged by lending at lower interest rates than they otherwise would have. The judge has already ruled that Donald Trump, his adult sons and their businesses were liable for persistent and repeated fraud in a summary judgment opinion before the trial began. He also ordered the dissolution of Trump's business certificates. Donald Trump has appealed the decision. Judge Engoron will determine how much the Trumps and their company must pay and the fate of their business in New York.
Welcome to this exclusive interview with Deputy Chairman of the Islamic Resistance Movement, Sheikh Saleh Al-Uluri. Hello and welcome, Sheikh Saleh.
Alaikum.
We will start first with the first question that everyone is curious about. What happened on October 7? We all heard the Israeli part of the story, but now we want to hear yours.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. هو أولا لابد من الوقوف عند أسباب 7 أكتوبر.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, at the beginning we must stop at the reason behind October the 7th. Why did it happen? Everybody knows very well that the last Israeli governments under the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu includes fanatic members such as Smotrich, Gantz, and some other figures. One of them said publicly, "We got to throw a nuclear bomb on Gaza Strip." This government, which was rejected even by the Western criteria, when those Israeli ministers traveled to the USA and Europe, no one welcomed them. Therefore, this government is being rejected by international criteria and standards. Because it is extremist and biblical, set its sight on very dangerous goals. The first of these goals is the control of Al-Aqsa Mosque and imposing Jewish sovereignty over it in order to change it to a Jewish synagogue according to a legislation in the Knesset. The second danger was the settlement. The Israelis had a plan regarding this matter. Their minister, Smotrich, was in charge of implementing it. This minister is very extremist in the settlement issue, and he is in charge of the army in the West Bank and Ministry of Finance. So he put a plan to settle 1 million settlers in the West Bank over 3 years, aiming at changing it to a Jewish majority. Moreover, he never hides his intention to expel the Palestinians from the West Bank. The third reason is the continuation of Gaza blockade for 16 years. The people of Gaza have been living in a big and open prison, but unfortunately, nobody is paying attention to this case and this ordeal. More than that, there is the Minister of National Security, the so-called Itamar Ben-Gvir, who was designated to be in charge of the national security in Israel, and who is taking very bad measures against our people in the 1948 territories, the West Bank, Al-Quds, and the Palestinian prisoners. To the extent that a legislation was submitted to the Knesset to execute Palestinian prisoners. So this current government has exceeded all red lines, and there is no way of remaining silent in front of it. What I would like to add is that the people of our world, particularly in the West, must realize that the reasons behind the eruption of the confrontation on October the 7th are very dangerous due to the policies of the Zionist government and the international policies. What I mean is that there are UN resolutions from the Security Council by giving a Palestinian state to the Palestinian people with Al-Quds as its capital and the right to self-determination, but however, there is an obvious disregard for all of Israel's actions that is canceling any chance for this solution. There is an awkward silence and a conspiracy. Support for Israel is increasing despite the existence of this extremist government and its refusal to implement the international resolutions and despite the approval of the Palestinian Liberation Organization of Oslo Agreement. What is being asked from the Palestinian people is to remain slaves to the Israelis, either under the siege in Gaza Strip or slavery in the West Bank and Al-Quds. For all previous mentioned reasons, we reached this solution. October the 7th wasn't something rare. That was a part of the Palestinian struggle to get its freedom and to live like other nations in the world, having its own independent state and its sovereignty. So this has been another stage of Palestinian people's stages in the modern history, but nevertheless, this stage has been a big and powerful one, created a big shock due to the extremist policies for the Israeli government and the international negligence. The West might not know that during the last meeting between President Biden and Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, in the city of Bethlehem, prior to the October the 7th, Abu Mazen asked the American president to acknowledge the right of the Palestinian people in having their own independent states. But President Biden replied that your problem is waiting for the return of Jesus. Of course, this reply was irresponsible. I can say that this answer was one of the factors that the recent conflict and the war started. Is this the stance of the international community? Therefore, October the 7th has been a ring in a chain of rings in our people's struggle against the Israeli occupation and its reluctance in implementing all international resolutions.
How has this operation changed the point of view of Hamas towards the occupation, towards their army that was undefeatable? I think that you have something to say about their army, especially we're seeing their defeats on the ground in Gaza.
No doubt that the battle of the October 7th created a surprise and a shock within the occupation, its army, its intelligence, and its people, who thought that they would live in peace, tranquility, and luxury while their neighbors are living in the hell. Of course, in the Israelis' point of view, the Palestinians are not neighbors, but rather a bunch of people who were uprooted from this soil while settlements were built on their land. For instance, more than half of the people who are currently residing in Gaza Strip had been uprooted from their villages and cities surrounding Gaza, which were converted into houses for the Israeli settlers. The operation carried out by Al-Qassam Brigades and other resistance factions caused this surprise and shock and meant to awaken the Israeli society and the world in general. These people did not remain silent about their rights, and they are capable of showing the world every time what is bigger and more dangerous. The negligence of the rights of the Palestinian people will affect negatively the international stability. All the world is living now on the reality of this battle. It became very clear that this army and its intelligence services were not more than a mirage. For this reason, the Israelis from the first day of the battle were willing to see the American aircraft carriers and airlift of weapons coming to their rescue. This society does not tolerate any defeat. It was said in the past by one of their leaders that the first defeat would be the last one for Israel.
لهذا الكيان.
Speaking about this, we know how hard it is now, the operations on the ground, especially in Khan Yunis and Shaja'iya. How strong is Hamas right now on the ground? And till when? It's been more than two months that we've been seeing the aggressions of the Israeli occupation. Till how long can Hamas stand strong in Gaza?
أنا أسمع طبعاً قادة الاحتلال الذين يقولون هذه المعركة.
I do hear some of the Israeli leaders that the aim of this battle is to eliminate Hamas movement, as if Hamas is an army of strangers living in Palestine. Hamas is the Palestinian people. It is an essential, central, and the biggest part of the Palestinian people. In all electoral processes since 2006, Hamas won the majority of the seats, which reflected the people's trust in Hamas, because all its programs have been at the service of our people. All Israelis' attempts to distort Hamas's image and present it as an extremist, terrorist, and Daesh organization have failed so far. For example, the world realized how Hamas fighters dealt with the Israeli captives. All the fighters came to bid farewell to them when they were released. The prisoners acknowledged in front of the cameras and media how kindly the fighters were dealing with them, feeding them with their own food, living with them in their places, while the Palestinian prisoners have been living in conditions similar to those of Nazi concentration camps, despite the Israelis' allegations about their democracy, freedom, and human rights. The Israelis are not ashamed of these allegations. They are beating and torturing our people on a daily basis. They force them to take off all their clothes in order to humiliate them by taking video clips of them while they are naked under the Israeli flag. Can't the resistance movements do the same? The families of the Israeli prisoners must know that their officials' way of dealing with our prisoners might lead Hamas to do the same with their relatives in the future. When the Israelis keep some prisoners in their jails for 40 years, do they expect the situation to remain the same? This is impossible. The Israelis must receive the same treatment. This is the story of Hamas and its steadfastness, because it is an essential part of the Palestinian people. We are not new to this nation, so defeating Hamas means defeating the Palestinian people. Should our people give up their rights, future, freedom, aspirations, their children's future, and their holy sites, agree to live as slaves with the Jews, Hamas might give up at the same time. But even this matter cannot be realized, because since the Zionist project, the Balfour Declaration, more than 100 years ago, our people have been fighting and struggling. Hamas is not an exception in this matter. It can fight and stand against the Israeli brutality. The Israelis have put their weight on the West Bank, which has been under their occupation since 1967. But what I'm telling you is that this situation will not last forever. There will be resistance in both Gaza and the West Bank, and the Israelis shall face resistance in other parts of Palestine as well. A whole generation has been directed to fight the occupation and to defend its people and their aspirations. This generation is armed with will, determination, faith, and holy sites that can inspire them to defeat the occupation forces. There is no doubt to that. I'm talking to the Israelis who are repeating their allegations by saying we are going to defeat Hamas and its fighters very soon. So they resort to comic plays and representations, such as arresting civilians in some schools, claiming they are prisoners from Hamas. If they are Hamas fighters under your arrest, why don't you distribute photos for them? What they have been doing is a desperate movement. They arrested old people claiming they were Hamas fighters. Our ability to go ahead with fighting till the defeat of the occupation is 100% certain. That is what I said 2 months ago. Many people were asking, would Israel succeed? I replied by saying we would be meeting in 6 months or a year later, and then the Israelis would beg the world to get them out of the hell that the resistance is giving them.
That much. Okay, you are very confident about this. So this confidence, where does it come from? Especially that we've been seeing Israel speaking about flooding the tunnels of Hamas with seawater, and they've been speaking about it a lot lately.
The most significant factor the Palestinian fighters possess is that they are people with a right and a just cause, and people who believe in it and are ready to sacrifice for it. This is the most significant thing we have, and more reliable than the tunnels and the missiles. When we have the will and determination, nothing can defeat us, and this war between them and us is a war of minds, wills, tools, and everything. The Israelis are doing their best to destroy the tunnels, and we, in turn, do what we can do.
Is it true that the tunnels are not connected? هل صحيح أن الأنفاق ليست متصلة في بعضها البعض؟
لا نتحدث بأي تفاصيل عن البنى العسكرية.
We are not going to talk about military infrastructure in detail. The tunnels issue is a part of military strategy. They were built and developed during our struggle with the Israeli occupation for tens of years, drawing lessons and developing our abilities. Whenever we find a loophole, the resistance movement does its best to close it and develop it through strength in order to prevent the enemy from surprising us. There might be small surprises in any battle, but in the previous battles, the enemy failed to destroy our complete strategy. There have been loopholes in our struggle, but we managed in closing them and drawing lessons from them.
So, since you are speaking about the powers of Hamas and on the ground, I don't know if you are going to answer this question, but can we know what kind of weapons does Hamas still have hiding there in the tunnels? The quantity, the quality, is it going to last Hamas for, as the Israelis are speaking, 1 year of war?
يعني يوجد أسلحة معروفة
There are known weapons being used publicly. For instance, there are missiles, anti-tank weapons, explosives, special rifles for snipers, and a variety of other rifles. All the weapons are available and have been used. Now, if the resistance fighters possess some special weapons for particular times, this is the matter of the resistance movement. I cannot talk about it. This is a topic for battle management, not to be discussed in the media.
Hamas officials have always said that they are not going after the treat. They said that they are not going for a swap again with the Israeli regime until they stop their aggression. So what would you call for? Are you going to call for all Palestinian prisoners to get out of Israeli prisons? And if Hamas now sits on the table, on the negotiation table, what would you ask for?
Regarding the captives issue, we have thousands of them in Israeli jails. Their number might have reached 10,000 after the Israelis' campaign in arresting our people in Gaza and the West Bank. All of them were civilians, not from our fighters. Some of the prisoners have been in jails for almost 40 years. Therefore, it is not possible anymore to remain silent about this issue. All of our captives in Israeli jails are freedom fighters, not criminals, as the enemy claims. Their cause is the most sacred and the most honorable. All over the world, people who volunteer to defend their people and demand their rights are being respected and appreciated and become icons for their own respective countries, and our captives and martyrs are our icons. So we had to take a decisive action to put an end to this tragedy. One of the goals of operations of October the 7th was to bring the captives with us to Gaza Strip. There has been a lot of talk going on about the presence of women and kids among the captives. What I want to explain here is that the decision inside Al-Qassam Brigade and other resistance movements in general was the arrest of Israeli soldiers. So the attack targeted the military division. Some of the personnel were killed while some others were arrested. As a result of the attack, there was a sudden collapse within the military division and a big surprise for them. A state of chaos by all standards prevailed there. For this reason, different people who were not within the resistance movement entered the battle. Yes, many people entered the battle. I heard that people came with their own vehicles, taking with them whoever they confronted, women and children. Then they handed them over to Al-Qassam Brigades, whose role was to gather those people in some specific places in order to save their lives. Those who were released later were forbidden from talking to the press and media by Israeli authorities because they talked to some people about the wonderful treatment they received from their jailers. From the first day, we said we do not mean to keep the civilians, but we have women and kids in Israeli jails, and they must be freed. This is non-negotiable. The exchange deal is something else. From the first day of the conflict, we said it clearly that the goal of keeping the Israeli military personnel was to free our captives who have been inside Israeli jails for tens of years. We said it very clearly. We were ready to hand over all the prisoners and the corpses in exchange for all of our captives and the corpses with the Israelis who used to kidnap our martyrs in the battlefield. Therefore, from the beginning, we wanted all for all. But the Israeli regime did not reply. They were concentrating on the women and kids. Even when we proposed the release of some civilian males, not soldiers, they refused the deal, saying we do not want them.
Why?
This current regime is working only to deceive the Israeli people. There has been a big pressure in the case of the women and the kids. They wouldn't ask about the other Israelis, even the soldiers. I would like to say in this occasion a very important point. Netanyahu, during his meeting with the families of the freed Israelis, I think he said some things which was recorded and went on the air by some Hebrew channels. He said, if Hamas offered all for all, we would accept it. But he was lying because we came up with an official and public offer from Mr. Al-Sunwar personally, who said we would be ready for the idea of all for all. I said this and Abu Ubaidah said it as well. That was our stance from the beginning. Because our goal was the freedom of our captives, we announced that we were not willing to keep the Israelis as human shields. What we were seeking was a human goal, and that was the freedom of our captives in Israeli jails. So the Prime Minister was lying to his society. Practically, I think this matter has to become very clear for the Israeli society and the international community. What he was talking about was the military operation to free his prisoners from Hamas. This matter is impossible. He failed in it for about 70 days, and the ground incursion inside Gaza, the Israelis succeeded in getting 3 corpses only. When they came close to free a living soldier in order to free him, they killed him, and 2 more soldiers were shot while others were wounded. So the idea of freeing the soldiers alive is totally impossible, but the real decision within the Israeli leadership states that let them be killed in the battle. We do not intend to pay the price. The wanted price is just. We are seeking the freedom of our captives who have been in Israeli jails for tens of years. It is a big crime to see freedom fighters behind bars for this long. Hamas offered the idea of all for all. The Israelis are promoting only lies. They have been saying that Hamas agreed for the release of women and children under heavy pressure. So we are going to exert more pressure on Hamas in order to force it to release our military men and women in an unjust deal or without any deal at all. For this particular reason, we took a decision to postpone the prisoners' issue till the end of this battle, as long as the Israelis are saying we are going to free our soldiers against Hamas's will. So this issue would be discussed after the termination of this battle, despite our all-for-all offer.
Especially that the American public are against what's happening in Gaza. I think we've seen all the rallies that are taking place in the United States against what's happening in Gaza and in support of ceasefire that the United States is voting always against. If we want to speak about the support, we're speaking about the American support to the regime in Israel. If you want to speak also about the support that you as Hamas are getting from the axis of resistance, we've seen Hezbollah in Lebanon since day one opening the border and launching strikes against Israel. Also, we've seen in Iraq the resistance as well launching attacks against bases of the United States and American bases. However, the most significant one was Ansarullah in Yemen, who are controlling now the Red Sea and forbidding any vessel or ship that is going to the occupied territories from crossing. How important is this support that you are getting from the resistance axis, and especially this of the Ansarullah al-Houthis?
نعم أولا الحجم الدعم الذي نتلقاه.
Yes, first, the size of the support we are receiving from various nations in the world as Palestinians. Thank God the amount of support is excellent and increasing. In America, the young generation is supporting the Palestinian just cause and its resistance while condemning the Israeli behavior and their administration's support for Israel. The same phenomenon is sweeping Europe, particularly Britain. In the Islamic and Arab world, we know that the nations are sincere in their stance towards Palestine, Quds and the resistance movements, but some abnormal voices coming out here and there are hired, and mercenaries have no connection to the conscience of the people. Regarding the official Arab stance, we can notice different contributions. There are those who are content with condemning and denouncing. There are those who register a position, and there are those who do something practical. 50 Arab and Muslim states met and took some decisions in supporting us, but unfortunately they were unable to implement them. A decision to break the siege, bring in humanitarian relief, and establish a ceasefire, but the Israelis did not pay attention to these decisions. That was very unfortunate that this regime, in its size and its presence in the world, is unable to implement a decision to protect its own people from being killed at the heart of the Islamic world. This is very unfortunate. But, however, we do appreciate any endeavor or action or support in championing this just cause. This is a natural human stance. On the other side, we see America imposes siege against states and places, dispatching its fleets to all over the world, inspecting the ships, while our brothers Ansarullah in Yemen prevents these ships from heading towards Israel unless the Israelis allow the entry of relief supplies to Gaza Strip. This is a classy behavior. You can notice the difference between two contradictory positions. America usually permits what it prohibits from others. The contribution of our brothers in Hezbollah in confronting the enemy in South Lebanon, presenting more than 100 mortars in their operations, is appreciated, because through these operations they succeeded in keeping more than one-third of the Israeli army in the north of the occupied Palestine, fearing the outbreak of an all-out war there. We are always seeking more support and getting in touch with all resistance factions. We appreciate all endeavors from the world and the resistance everywhere. Returning to the Yemen position, which stated, as long as there is a siege against Palestinian people, there must be an imposed siege on the Zionist entity. We are hoping that all Islamic and Arab states within the world take practical actions against Israel in order to convey this message to it. You cannot commit the most heinous of crimes and remain unpunished.
You are always very optimistic, and that's really good to hear. Thank you so much, Deputy Chairman of the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, Sheikh Saleh Al-Aruri, for this exclusive interview.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our latest episode of Path